Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com. Spout presents Butterknife, a new generation detective series made by a new generation of filmmakers. Find out more at butterknife.spout.com. And by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting today for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. It's great to be back after a week off. I wish I could say that we were fully relaxed and recharged, Matty, but I think ready will have to suffice. Coming up on the show, the answers to this week's top five are blowing in the wind as we share our top five 60s movies, not the best of the decade, but the best movies set in the 60s.
Yes, plus listener feedback, Massacre Theater, more new music from Wilder Embry, and we kick off our Pedro Almodovar marathon with a discussion of The Flower of My Secret.
But first, free speech is having the right to yell theater in a crowded fire. Abbie Hoffman and company take the stage in Brett Morgan's Chicago 10.
Intent to incite, is that the key line? Intent to incite. Did you intend to incite? And it's not concerned.
It's a state of mind trial. I mean, we're being tried for our thoughts.
We're charged with carrying certain ideas across state lines, not with carrying machine guns or carrying little girls or little boys or any other kind of. Charged with having a certain state of mind when we go from New York and to Pennsylvania to Indiana and then finally into Illinois.
Matty, do you remember your introduction to the Chicago 7 the first time they came on your radar?
Yeah, I do remember. It was a made-for-TV movie conspiracy trial of the Chicago 8 starring Peter Boyle and Brian Benben and a couple others. Great film. My friend's dad had it on VHS, and I remember we watched it one time in high school. I was hooked.
We actually have a shared experience then. That was my introduction to them as well, a 1987 HBO docudrama. We watched a ton of HBO back in the 80s. Conspiracy, the trial of the Chicago 8. Your boy Peter Boyle was in it playing David Dellinger. Robert Carradine was Rennie Davis. Elliot Gould and Robert Loggia played defense attorneys Leonard Weinglass and William Kunstler.
I have to say, it might sneak into my top five. I'm just warning you.
We will see. I was in junior high at the time and remember very little in the way of specifics from the movie. But
I was much younger.
Much younger? Yeah. Much younger, uh-huh. I certainly recall, though, being captivated by the courtroom antics of Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, leaders of the Youth International Party, or YIPPIES, who, along with members of the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, were indicted in 1969 for conspiracy to incite riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention here in Chicago. Rubin once said that anyone who calls us the Chicago 7 is a racist because you're discrediting Bobby Seale. You can call us the Chicago 8, but really we're the Chicago 10 because our two lawyers went down with us, hence the title of writer-director Brett Morgan's new film, which combines archival footage and animated courtroom reenactments to bring the events of August 1968 and the subsequent trial to life, complete with a contemporary rock-driven soundtrack and the voice work of Hank Azaria, Mark Ruffalo, and Liev Schreiber, among other talented performers. Now, Matty, we considered several films to review this week. The Bank Job is getting a lot of praise. The Band's Visit and City of Men are a couple intriguing art house picks currently in theaters. But you were most excited to see and discuss Chicago 10 because not only are you a history buff, but you are keenly interested in this particular era and event. You still bear the emotional scars of the Christmas where you beg Santa to bring you the Tom Hayden Chicago 7 action figure, only to find that he had brought you John Froines instead. Incidentally, I think Froines and Lee Weiner actually have as much screen time in Chicago 10 as you and I do.
Yeah.
Did Brett Morgan satiate your Chicago 7 counterculture hunger? And if not, did he at least whet your appetite? Or, to paraphrase the dreamy commie beatnik Michael Fitzsimmons from a movie that just missed my top five this week, Peggy Sue Got Married, were you driven to check out of this bourgeois motel, push yourself away from the dinner table, and say, "No more Jell-O for me, Mom"?
Yeah, man, I'm right there with you, man. I do have to say, it whet my appetite. It did do that. I really was excited to see this film, as you touched on. I love the 1960s. And the reason I'm so fascinated with it, of course, I was born in the late 80s, but my parents...
Stop it.
Apparently, they claim they lived through the 60s and their 20s. And I don't believe them for a second because they are the squarest individuals you'd ever meet.
Now, says a lot about you, Matt.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, granted, my dad's a jazz musician, but he claims he never heard the Beatles and this kind of stuff. And so I've been trying to educate them for the past 15 years on what they actually missed out on. And my entree into the 1960s was basically Hubert Humphreys, one of my idols. And you go back 1948, Hubert Humphrey, this little mayor, makes a speech at the 1948 Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and it's revolutionary for its time. And he's pleading with the Democratic National Committee to include a plank on civil rights. And of course, he famously calls for America to step out of the shadows of states' rights and walk forthrightly in the sunshine of human rights. And that was revolutionary for its day.
I know where you're going
with
this.
Exactly. And of course, the Mississippi delegation famously up and walked out, the segregated delegation. Fast forward 20 years now. Unfortunately, Humphrey has become the establishment, and his voice, his progressive voice of change, has manifest itself much more aggressively. It's much, much more radical. And now these voices are going to descend on Chicago. They're coming to the Democratic National Convention, the same one he spoke at 20 years earlier, but they're not going to work within the machinations of the convention itself. They're going to protest outside. They feel abandoned by their party. And of course, it completely blows up. You've got Richard Daley's Chicago, this old school politician. You've got this convention taking place in the shadow of the stockyards, and famously, the violence erupts, and 4 days later, basically America is scarred, and the Democratic National Committee and Humphrey doesn't survive it. And I think Morgan does a really, really nice job of using the archival footage here to give you a sense of what was going on mm-hmm. at the time, especially within the trial and outside the trial. He shows you what's going on in Grant Park.
Lincoln Park, yeah.
In Grant Park and across from the Hilton. It's all very, very great theater, but in the end, that's my problem with the film. When the Chicago 8 were on trial, they were putting on a show. They were acting infantile. They were trying, to show the lunacy of this trial itself, and they succeed in doing that. But the footage we have outside of the trial is just more of the same. It's just more of them in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. It's Jerry Rubin giving a speech. It's Abbie Hoffman giving a speech. David Dellinger making a speech over and over again. And it failed really to me to show who these people are. Who are these disparate voices? Abbie Hoffman, this Jewish guy from New York with crazy hair. And why is he uniting alongside David Dellinger and Rennie Davis, who look like tax accountants or members of the Letterman? What's their story? What in society is forging them to act out like this? What is sparking this revolution in each and every one of them? And it's not enough for Morgan to simply throw up a picture of LBJ every now and then, or a couple of shots of helicopters, for us to understand what's driving them to protest mm-hmm. To spark this revolution. And I think he really missed an opportunity here to flesh out the characters in the story. And the end result, I think the whole movie is really pretty flat.
Yeah, actually, I agree with you. And we could have potentially had a really good fight here, because I saw this movie back at the 2007 Sundance Film Festival. It opened the festival. And at that time, I really liked the movie. And I mm-hmm. want to say right off the top here, maybe I need to apologize to Brett Morgan, to you, to our listeners, because I absolutely cannot reconcile the difference in my reaction between 2007 January and now here in March 2008, because it was very different. And I thought I knew the reasons, and we'll get into that a little bit here in a minute, but I'm not sure that I have the data to back that up. But I did have a very different experience. I do want to comment on the things I did like about the movie, though. You mentioned the theatrical aspect of it. I love what Morgan does with combining the guerrilla theater tactics that these guys were using. And you talked about it when we discussed Ingmar Bergman's Shame a few weeks ago, the fact that it was kind of this absurdist theater mm-hmm. in the eyes of, realizing that we have the bomb and we all are going to die, and you have to do things to kind of shake things up. They came to Chicago knowing that Daley would play right into their hands. Their whole scheme was that they would just basically protest and Chicago would turn into a police state, that he would not let them do that. And then those images, what the public would see on TV, would be what the American public needed to see.
The whole world is watching.
Exactly, to be swayed against the war. It had to be brought home to them in that way. And so then the courtroom scenes play perfectly right into that, into those riot scenes, because the judge and the prosecutors take the bait just like Daley mm-hmm. and the cops do. When you actually have Judge Julius Hoffman putting Bobby Seale, a black man, in chains and gagging him. I mean, can you imagine if that was televised at the time, or the uproar something like that would cause today? Right. And it's a great moment that Morgan does handle really well, because it even leaves Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin speechless. There's nothing to say. it just plays right into their hands. The judge does exactly what they want him to do.
I don't
want
to get you off your tangent here, but I would just say, doesn't the rotoscoping animation that he uses there somewhat temper the effect of that scene?
Maybe
imagine if you really had a live actor being gagged and bound. I think it hits home much more.
Maybe it does, but I actually think that the animation works because rather than being just a gimmick, it becomes functional when you look at the whole thing as theater, as a circus, as a cartoon. Why not look like one then? I think that Morgan is onto something there. I also think he really gets right the fact that this, more than anything, was a generational gap issue. What was on trial was their cultural beliefs. I mean, you have Allen Ginsberg testifying,
yeah,
and you have the prosecutor.
Yeah, but you had Norman Mailer there, too.
Sure.
I don't think it's just generational.
You have him asking him about his poetry on the stand,
yeah,
because he knows that that's going to distance them from the, you know, home and garden set that's on the jury. And he asks him to read his poem, and all those people look on and discuss, and they can't believe what they're hearing. So I think that that is a huge part of it. Even the great moment, we see some of this great newsreel footage, and we have this wonderful scene where we have a newscaster staring deadpan into the camera, reporting what happened at the trial that day, saying, and then Allen Ginsberg proceeded to try to relax mm-hmm. the courtroom with a chant. The chant went, I mean, that's how he does this chant. I mean, it's really funny stuff, and I think it gets that aspect right, that what was more on trial than anything was the counterculture.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think he gets the trial exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted, though, was outside of that, flesh out these characters more. What happened? Abbie Hoffman has never met a camera he didn't like.
Sure.
And we get to see him constantly exposed. And what I wanted to see is what happens when he takes the mask off. What happens when
I don't know if he ever did.
Show me. What do you think happens? There's far too few scenes of them just living their lives. Basically, it's them always on. And it's interesting with the animation in that if you rotoscope, what that allows you to do is to put these people in fantastic situations.
Sure.
You know, we saw that in Waking Life. He rarely does that outside of the trial. You know, there's that one scene
there's
where they're trying to get the permit from the city of Chicago, and I think one of them, it might be Hoffman, is shown.
No, Ginsberg.
It's a Ginsberg.
Of course.
Is shown
he's
floating.
He's meditating.
Yeah,
floating
he's shown
in the air.
Floating in the office. Well, that's kind of fun. I like that. There you're using the animation to sort of forward the idea of who these people are, the ridiculousness of the situation.
Sure.
But that was about it. That's about the only time. Any other time, it's Abbie Hoffman in concert.
I know.
Or it's him on the radio. And that's fine. But they're not the most profound people in the world. They have about five different speeches. I completely believe in their cause. I'm not dismissing them. But what he needed to do was just to bring it home a little bit more. Why were they so angry? Who were these people?
Well, I think what Morgan might say to that is, if you're following the transcripts, if you're following things we have on the record, if
yeah.
you're trying to be kind of accurate, which I think he is, then all you have are those moments where they are, for the most
but
part,
then that,
on camera.
But that does not a movie make. That would be my argument. Then
okay.
it's just a series of images thrown at me, and it can really kind of wear me out.
Well, and I think that's what happened largely
yeah.
here. But I actually would make the counterargument, even though I ultimately, in the end, agree with you. I think that I do appreciate what Morgan tried to do in that he didn't try to paint a sweeping portrait of 60s radicalism or explain all the reasons why Vietnam is bad. At this point, don't we all kind of take it as a given that Vietnam was wrong? And just from a practical standpoint, it would be way too much to tackle. That said, the lack of context here and the lack of attention to some of the key players really is kind of shocking. I mean, Richard Daley's barely in the movie.
Whoa.
Hubert Humphrey, the candidates, no one is here.
What's going on in the convention? I mean, at one point, Daley gets called out. There's a great little scene that happens in there, and we only get one scene of Cronkite.
Right.
And you know, Cronkite basically is narrating this to the American public. Yeah.
And that's a great moment, but that does then feed into what you're saying and what Tom Hayden, who has been in support of this movie doing press, but his one big complaint is that, you know, it's kind of just a big love fest of Abbie Hoffman. It's kind of just
yeah,
a
very
movie
much, very
glorifying
much.
Him in some ways. And that's fine for me because I really like Abbie Hoffman. I like his charisma. I think he's a fascinating figure. I love that clown character he portrays. But the movie does spend too much time on those little Hoffman asides, like those bits where he's talking to the guy at the radio station in New York. And my point is, you know what, if you're not going to get into all those other things going on in society and all these other subplots and characters, that's fine. But you got to make then the moments you do choose to show me really crucial. And
yeah.
those aren't it.
Yeah, exactly. You said it 10,000 times better than I could. Why is this idealism? You have to show me why this idealism is being forged.
Mm-hmm.
You say we know why the Vietnam War is bad. No, you can't really give that. You can't assume that.
But
if
that's also
if
its
you're telling
own
a story,
film, though. That's its own movie unto
so,
itself.
So then what do I get? I just get the fallout?
Yes.
All right.
Because otherwise you're getting a six-part epic miniseries.
No. This can be done. What I get here is a show without context, and it's just a little bit too repetitive.
Okay. Well, I do want to say, when I touched on earlier my different reaction to the film, I talked about the things I liked about it, some things I didn't. Those are all still valid from what I saw at the time. But the biggest difference for me is that when I saw it at Sundance, my perception of the film, my recollection of it, was that it was wall-to-wall rock music, the Rage Against the Machine, the Beastie Boys stuff, Eminem. We get all this contemporary music. It was over every riot scene. It was over every courtroom scene. And I know a lot of people didn't really like that, but I actually really did like it, because what it made the movie for me was more than a documentary, an experience. It was this kind of visual and oral assault, and it worked as propaganda. I mean, Brett Morgan made this film because he wanted to try to galvanize a movement against the Iraq War. And at the time we saw it, January 07, this movie opens with LBJ talking about how we're going to have a surge in troop movement in Vietnam. In January 07, that's when the surge was announced. It was all very prescient, and it really worked. And the movie, with that music, with that heavy rock music, whether I like the music or not, it works so well in terms of just getting me galvanized, getting me pumped up. It made me want to get out there. It made me want to get involved. And I loved the anger and the outrage of it. This time watching it, I didn't get that sense at all. Yeah. I felt like the music was more background music. I felt like there was a lot more of just traditional kind of symphonic pieces and music that is in the courtroom trying to kind of highlight the absurdity of everything. I didn't get that outrage from the music. And I just want to say, why I said I maybe need to apologize is that I did contact some publicity people, and they got to Brett Morgan and asked him my question whether or not he changed any of the music. And this is his exact quote. He says he didn't cut any musical sequences. So, in fact, the film has more music per minute now than at Sundance, because he actually did tweak 4 or 5 minutes out of the movie. He's saying he didn't make any changes to it. I'm just telling you, that was my reaction at the time. I felt like it was wall-to-wall music, and it really swept me up in it. I didn't have that reaction at all this time, and I can't really account for it if I'm wrong.
Oh, it's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, obviously now, in what was it, February?
January 07.
Obviously now, March 08, the surge we know has worked.
Oh, of course.
So you're completely at ease.
Well, you wonder if culturally that does factor in. There was more outrage at that point.
Well, you know, and I think you hit on something. The reason that this film really sort of left me hollow was at the end. I didn't feel energized. I didn't feel angry.
And I didn't this time either.
I didn't feel anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's my biggest complaint.
Okay. Well, Chicago 10 is out now in limited release. If you agree or disagree with our take, send an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463. And we do want to say we're very aware that Chicago 10 is playing, I think, in about 6 or 8 cities right now. And obviously, we do recommend maybe checking it out.
Check it out on
DVD. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
But it is something we felt like it would be interesting to dive into. I'm glad we did.
Okay. Time for a quick break. To completely gloss over Matthew McConaughey, Kate Hudson, and Paul Walker, what were you guys thinking? Your feedback on the most annoying actors in Hollywood is up next. Stay with us.
Push like a dozer through. Settle and feel. I wriggle like a diver, gasping for air. Believe in the power of us, each and every one. Then I fade like a spirit, I get nothing done. And it's just that I feel like I'm joking. When I say, Lord, help me be, like my faith is just karaoke to the very, very real thing.
Hi, Adam and Maddie. This is John from Minot, North Dakota, calling to leave you a voicemail regarding your top 5 actors we wouldn't cast in our movies. And I do give the actors from Star Wars a lot of credit for dealing with the scripts that George Lucas gives them. But I've seen Hayden Christensen in other movies, and he's no better in those. My top 5 list would personally include 5, Mr. Christensen himself. 4, Sandy Newton, who you may recognize as Terrence Howard's wife from Crash. 3, Nicolas Cage. Oh boy, how I don't like him, except for Raising Arizona. Jake Gyllenhaal. And 1, Randy Quaid, who I personally find the king of overacting and obnoxious enough to the point where I can't really enjoy movies that he's in.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. John with a voicemail there, Maddie chiming in on his top five actors he wouldn't cast in his movie. This was a top five list of ours from a few weeks back. And some interesting choices there. His number one, though, Randy Quaid. An inspired choice or just a bizarre choice?
I love Randy Quaid.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. I looked at his filmography on IMDb after we got John's voicemail, and I looked, and he just hasn't really been in a lot of films that are maybe worth talking about.
What are you talking about?
The Last Detail, and the Vacation movies I would single out. Other than that, I know he has a brief role in Brokeback Mountain, which I like a lot, but he's been in a lot of junk.
Well, that's all right. That's not enough to condemn him as an actor.
No, it's not. You're absolutely right. I'm just saying it's an interesting choice, though, to single out someone who isn't in very many good movies.
He must really annoy him.
Yeah.
He must really, really annoy him.
It sounded like he did. Let's move on to our poll questions. We're going to get into some more great feedback from you in a moment, but we did want to share the results of our most recent poll question on filmspotting.net. We were wrapping up our Ingmar Bergman marathon, so we asked you, which is Ingmar Bergman's best film? And here were the choices: Fanny and Alexander, The Seventh Seal, Shame, Smiles of a Summer Night, Wild Strawberries, Other, or I Wish I Had an Opinion. Maybe I just haven't seen enough Ingmar Bergman films to really weigh in. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, number one was Wish I Had an Opinion.
I guess 49%. They didn't follow along.
Why am I doing this?
I know.
If no one's playing along at home. Number two, The Seventh Seal at 19%, 3 Wild Strawberries, 11%, Other at 9%, Fanny and Alexander, 7%, Winter Light, 4%, Shame, 1%, Smiles of a Summer Night, 0%, for Shame. Come on, guys. He's really not that daunting. I was as scared as you guys were before tackling this marathon, and I was rewarded.
Yeah, and a lot of people, of course, mentioned in the comments to the poll that they voted Other. They went for movies like Persona, Scenes from a Marriage, The Virgin Spring. Those are actually all movies I've seen and
I've
like
seen,
very much,
yeah.
But we actually didn't include them in the poll just because they weren't part of our marathon, and I obviously threw Other in there because it could cover a lot of other films. But I was a little surprised that Wish I Had an Opinion was number one. Hopefully, many more of our listeners will investigate Ingmar Bergman. This week's poll question ties in with our upcoming review of Gus Van Sant's film Paranoid Park, which I believe we are planning to review next week on the show. And so we want to know how you feel about him. We're asking, my Gus Van Sant preference is...
A, art house Gus. B, experimental Gus. C, mainstream Gus. Or D, no Gus at all.
And of course, art house Gus, I would include in that movies like Drugstore Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho, and To Die For. Experimental Gus, you've got Elephant, Jerry, Last Days, some of the more recent stuff. And then mainstream Gus, Good Will Hunting, Finding Forrester, and Psycho. Maddie, I'm really afraid to ask you where you're voting in this poll question.
I'm way very heavily in the art house Gus.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I thought you were going to go no Gus at all.
No. I love it. I'm always entertained by a Gus Van Sant film, except for pretty much mainstream Gus. I like Good Will Hunting, but Finding Forrester and Psycho?
I know.
Are you kidding me?
I know, but I will accept. If people vote for that, we will say right now that we do understand that you aren't necessarily supporting those films. Maybe
right,
you're
okay.
Just a huge right. Good Will Hunting fan. I think that's fair to vote for mainstream Gus, but I'm with you. I go with art house Gus. I love those films. In fact, we were initially going to ask what your favorite Gus Van Sant film is, and I didn't know how I was going to vote in that poll question because I do love Drugstore Cowboy and My Own Private Idaho, To Die For
as
well.
You're kind of giggly over this guy, aren't you?
I like him a lot, and I'm looking forward to discussing Paranoid Park. I'm looking forward to seeing it again after seeing it in Toronto. A couple of quick notes before we get into the mailbag. We did want to mention that we are getting a lot of requests, and this is very flattering, of course, from people like Luke and Saskatoon wanting to know if we will be podcasting our Hawks Curtiz class that we're teaching at the University of Chicago starting in April. And unfortunately, the answer, Maddie, is no, because no. Even if it was something we could do and we haven't talked to the school
about
that.
We don't own the rights to that class, right?
Well, I don't know how that would work or not, but the fact is it's a three-hour class where we watch the film and we have a lot of discussion. And sure, there will be some small lecturing, but really I'm not sure how you would podcast or even mic everyone in a classroom discussion.
Well, we simulcast the film.
There you
and
go.
Then we keep the mics live on you and I, and we give a running commentary as it's going on.
No, but it really is, of course, great to hear that people are interested. Of course, we have a lot of listeners who would love to take the class but aren't in the Chicago area. Of course, if you want more information about that, you can learn more by going to filmspotting.net.
And we also have one correction from Jobert Atienza. Josh Brolin will be playing George H.W. Bush in Oliver Stone's upcoming film. I think you said you accredited that Roland was going to be playing Bush W.
I assume that's who he would play, yes. And in fact, he is playing Bush Sr., which now I have a hard time seeing that. So that will be interesting. Obviously, a younger version of Bush Sr., we will see, but thank you, Joe Bear, for the correction.
I think Dylan Baker would make a good George H.W.
Dylan Baker, who is in Chicago 10,
yeah,
Rennie
exactly.
Davis. So, nice connection there. All right, well, Maddie, actually, we have another segment to get to before we get into our feedback, and we are dying to share this segment with you. It is one we introduced a few weeks ago on the show. Here comes Maddie's Movie Minute.
Maddie's Movie Minute. He takes us to the show for 60 seconds or so and gets right to the point of what we need to know.
And now,
here's Maddie.
Will Ferrell takes the ball up the right side, top of the key, spins, finds Woody Harrelson, and both shoot to score in a spoof of the defunct American Basketball Association in this new sports comedy, Semi-Pro. If you're an ABA or Will Ferrell fan, I would suggest renting this film. If you're a fan of neither, then I say skip it. Unfortunately, this film doesn't deliver comedically or story-wise, and it really strives to do both. It's not offensively Blades of Glory bad, but Jackie Moon is not that endearing of a lead character to sustain our interest through some pretty lame material.
Maddie's Movie Minute. Maddie's Movie Minute. Quick reviews to help you choose it. Maddie's Movie Minute.
Maddie, you asked for theme music.
Wow.
We got theme music. We have to thank Jorn and Jessica in Valdosta, Georgia, for the wonderful opening theme to Maddie's Movie Minute, and then Tom Knight in Ithaca, New York, for his wonderful closing theme. Our listeners are so incredibly talented. I don't know if it's a good thing that the intro and outro music's better than the segment itself,
yeah, exactly.
No offense, and maybe even longer, but it's a blast to play. So we're going to keep busting out Maddie's Movie Minute on future shows.
Yeah, exactly. What is the sound of 20,000 people simultaneously fast-forwarding their podcast?
Right to that point. I'll tell you what, after I got that initial theme from Jorn and Jessica, I had it in my head for 48 hours,
yeah.
And you will all be singing it all day long, and you can send your hate mail to us, and we'll forward it to Jorn and Jessica for putting it in your head. But again, thanks to them and to Tom. Really fun stuff there. Let's get into the mailbag, though, Maddie, because we really did get a ton of great feedback on the actors we wouldn't cast in our movie. Some people agreeing with some of our choices, some people really disagreeing with some of our choices. We'll start with Marco in Detroit.
Marco writes, Natalie Portman, Scarlett Johansson, Brad Pitt, these are some of our better actors. You even admit to liking them in certain films, Adam. If that weren't bad enough to completely gloss over Matthew McConaughey shirtless acting, Kate Hudson, I think I am cuter than I am acting, Paul Walker, dude, I think I'm cooler than I am acting, bro, is a total mystery to me. Not only are these three bad in one movie, they are repeat offenders. What were you guys thinking, i.e., smoking?
Yes.
Oh, I actually got my hands on some Matthew McConaughey stuff.
Did you?
I love McConaughey. I think he's kind of a genius right now. I don't know what he's doing, but I am willing to go along with
okay.
him.
Okay, well, we got a lot of listeners who echoed what Marco had to say there, including Ryan in State College, PA, who said that the omission of McConaughey from our list was almost as bad as when we left the wood chipper scene from Fargo off of our top five Coen Brothers moments. Listen, Matthew McConaughey, Kate Hudson, Paul Walker, those for me all fall into that category of why are you dumping on them? I mean, we know they make bad movies. We know they're bad actors. And granted, I did include a couple of those in my top five. Maybe you could say Cuba Gooding Jr. has been in a lot of junk and Hayden Christensen too. But the fact is, that's like shooting fish in a barrel. It just seemed too easy.
I mean, Marco, isn't this good that he knows he has no interest in seeing something like Fool's Gold because he hates both Hudson and McConaughey?
There you go. It's very productive in that way. Well, Darcy the Cutie in Tasmania, Australia writes, actors I wouldn't talk to even fictionally. And she's broken them down by category here, Maddie. Smug, Anthony Hopkins and Kevin Spacey. Stale, IKEA Knightley and Orlando Bland. Losing It, Christopher Plummer and Jodie Foster. Stand Down rather than Stand Up, Martin Lawrence and Kevin James. And then Asses, Liam Neeson and
Liam
James Spader.
Neeson? What are you talking about? Well, James Spader plays an ass really, really well.
Yes, he does.
What are you talking about? Liam Neeson, the Swamp Fox? Come on.
I do like Liam Neeson as well, but there are some good choices in there. And Keira Knightley, certainly, as we're going to find out here in just a second,
Cece
came
in Denver,
up a lot.
Yeah, she agrees. I am shocked Keira Knightley did not make the list, especially over Laura Linney, who at least can enunciate clearly. Best line of 2008 so far. Nearly every performance of hers is unwatchable. I cringe every time her mumbled lines come across in the theater. So far, she has ruined two adaptations of a beloved books, Pride and Prejudice and now Atonement. The movie would have had a much better chance in the Oscar race if not for her.
Yeah, Keira Knightley did come up a lot, as we mentioned. Matthew Katz in Alfred, New York wrote in, speaking of Laura Linney, calling Knightley an age-appropriate pouting device.
Yeah, well, you like Knightley, don't
well,
you?
Well, I just said I do think she is good in Atonement, but I do think I've been on the record. I didn't like her in Pride and Prejudice. That is true. I also think she is really bland, along with Orlando Bloom, in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, at least the last two. Kind of liked her in the first one, but I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. I want to see more of a body of work from Keira Knightley before I'm going to write her off as IKEA Knightley. Josh Hall in Bloomington, Indiana. How could you include someone like Drew Barrymore, Maddie, though I agree, in your picks for worst actors? Every eyebrow raise and nose twitch are so irresistibly cute that you can't help but be sucked into her strange little world of self-aware script reading. The scene from Ever After is heart-wrenching, even though it probably shouldn't be. The worst offense of your list, however, was leaving Owen Wilson off of it. His flat, leery expressions and drone of voice makes me want to throw something. When you combine his obnoxiousness with any film, especially cheeky Wes Anderson nonsense, it transcends the so-bad-it's-funny range and moves toward please never put this person in a movie again territory.
Well, despite the fact that I think Josh is probably Drew Barrymore's agent, I will completely agree that Owen Wilson is on the precipice, really sort of teetering towards this, oh my God, I don't want to watch him on screen
anymore.
Well,
he's going to Matthew McConaughey territory as well with some of his choices of projects. He's not picking a lot of good stuff lately.
That's right. He's got one coming out,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, Drillbit Taylor
or
something
Taylor,
like
right.
that.
Ooh.
I don't know, but I actually think Owen Wilson was one of the better performers, though, in the Darjeeling Limited.
Yeah,
I liked him in that movie.
Yeah, he was a little bit more subdued. Well, Scott Hamm writes in with his top five choices. Number five, Keanu Reeves. An obvious choice, but if you think Hayden Christensen has a bad delivery, Keanu wins the award. No one behind the wheel. Number four, uh-oh, Adam.
I know.
Kurt Russell.
Fighting words.
Kurt Russell has never been interesting to me. A hairpiece with no charisma.
Wow.
He's never felt tough, never feels smart, never intrigues me. He makes Tombstone almost unwatchable, and his presence prevented me from seeing Grindhouse.
We're talking about Grindhouse, Tombstone, Snake Plissken. We're talking about Big Trouble in Little China.
Russell. I'm sorry.
Craziness, Scott.
All right. Nicolas Cage is his number three.
More craziness.
All right, well, I can almost, let me finish this, okay? Let me finish this. Number three, Nicolas Cage. He raised Arizona and then ruined his career. The drawl in his voice makes anything but Honeymoon in Vegas yelling sound unintelligent. I can't look at him without seeing greed and nepotism. Mm. I will have to admit, Cage does bug me sometimes.
Okay.
And in The Weatherman, did you
it.
See The Weatherman? What did
yes.
you think of that?
I thought it was okay.
Oh, it bugged me.
It didn't bug me as much, but I know many people feel the way you do.
All right, going on to number two, Sharon Stone. Sharon loves the limelight but doesn't have the acting chops to justify it. Her post-Basic Instinct films are all horrible until somehow Martin Scorsese allowed her to overact her way through Casino. Every performance seems like a glamour turn. Look, I don't have any problem with Sharon Stone's acting. I think especially her turn in Casino is terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And there's number one here, Adam. Look, I'm sorry. It's time to get Scott Hamm back on his meds. Bruce Willis. I'm not making a Die Hard movie, and that's the only role of his that works for me. His pursed lips convey 24 hours smugness, his ego always on his sleeve. He's never shown humbleness since David Addison on Moonlighting or John McClane. His cameo as himself in Ocean's 12 just reminded me how much he thinks of himself.
He's an actor.
Yeah.
They're supposed to, by design.
Exactly. Very yeah. well put. I love Willis. What do you want him to do? I don't want to see his leer, but I don't mind him coming on and exactly delivering everything like he's going to.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to get a solid turn.
No,
I know
like
he
him.
Believes everything he's saying.
I like him in the M. Night Shyamalan films, too. I like him in Unbreakable, and I like him in The Sixth Sense. I think he's going for a very understated thing, and I think for the most part, it works. What?
You
it
should
is.
Be his agent, too.
I should be.
Yeah,
it's understated.
It's understated.
Yeah. I can spin it however you want. Well, let's close with this one from Stephen Flores, a.k.a. The Void 99. His number one, Tom Cruise. I'll quote Gilmore Girls. Where would you sit Tom Cruise? In an acting
Are
class.
You kidding me?
Number
Come
two,
on, people.
Cuba Gooding Jr. overacts in nearly everything and overdoes it. Why did he win an Oscar? He was on my list. Julia Stiles on your list, Maddie. She can't act. I can't stand her or her voice. Jessica Alba, number four. Again, maybe I'd put in that Paul Walker category is too easy to pick on.
Mm-hmm.
Number five, Annette Bening. If she's overacting, I have to leave the room. And I will say this about Annette Bening, who I've always liked. I loved her in American Beauty when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
I will admit to watching about 30 minutes of American Beauty a few nights ago, maybe even a couple weeks ago now at this point, and her scenes, I found them unbearable to watch. I couldn't believe how big she was. It totally threw me. I was like, wow, did I really watch the same performance? Because I thought she was horrible.
Now, I think what we're finding is these actors or actresses that just rub people the wrong way. Yeah. I really don't think, I think these people couch their arguments a lot in terms of acting. I don't actually think it's their problems with their acting. It's just something about them they don't like.
We touched on that. Yeah. You're right. A lot of times it is. It's just something that bothers you. I mentioned that even about Scarlett Johansson, something about the voice, and it just doesn't work for me. But I will say as well, the one that really bugs me, and a lot of people wrote in, they're guilty of it. I'm not trying to chide you, but the one I really don't get is when people bring in the actors away from the screen, their personal lives. They hate Tom Cruise because he's a Scientologist.
Yeah, makes
Whether
no sense.
I buy into that or not, it has nothing to do with how I watch him on screen or his talent.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, you're a Scientologist.
Yes, I am.
People are going to write in now and write you off.
Okay, well, we do have to close there, unfortunately. We could spend all day going through this great feedback. As always, if you have a comment for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater and Adam and I dance a ceremonial flamenco as we begin our Pedro Almodovar marathon. Stay with us.
I was only trying to hang out, but I need fuel to hide the doubt. Before I know it, I'm a black freight train, fuel in my chamber of pain. And I don't want to be morose, it's not so sure of the path I chose. And if that ship came in, I didn't. If I did, I'd only flee it. Now it's morning and I'm crying, with thoughts only of me dying. Flurry of thoughts that never lead to any answers for me. And I don't want.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like FilmSpotting. Log on to audible.com/FilmSpotting to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. That's audiblepodcast.com/FilmSpotting for your free audiobook.
Fast, I have this sudden impulse to turn the wheel quickly, head on into the oncoming car. I can anticipate the explosion, the sound of shattering glass, the flames rising out of the flowing gasoline.
Right. Well, I have to go now, Dwayne, because I'm due back on the planet Earth.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Alongside me, Matty Robinson, is the gorgeous, the talented Adam Kempinar. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a scene from a movie and you get a shot at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, we massacred the scene you just heard with Woody Allen and Christopher Walken, or at least really bad impressions of them from Annie Hall, a tie-in with our 200th episode celebration.
Yes, in the absence of a scene between Walken and Al Pacino, that had to be the scene for our 200th episode with Walken and Woody Allen together. You and Sam got to bust out your funny voices. And Andy from New York wrote in and said, "Thank you for butchering Annie Hall again." And I went, "Again?" And I went back and looked at the Massacre Theater winners page and discovered that we did Annie Hall here on the show last February. A different scene, obviously, but we did a scene from Annie Hall tying in with the Oscars. And I can't believe it. I can't believe we busted out Annie Hall twice. Certainly deserving of being massacred twice.
Yeah, exactly. If there is a film that's deserving of it. But does this set a precedent now? A bad precedent?
Maybe so. Maybe we can go back and revive some of our films? Maybe so.
All right, Adam. We'll reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is John Damer from the San Francisco Bay Area. Congratulations, John. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Oh, yeah, makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, you know, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Okay, what about you, Chet? I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block, it's really going to open things up for me.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it does tie in with this week's top five. Maddie is getting ready over here. I wish you could see it.
I'm getting my script ready here.
You are. It's really wonderful to watch. It does tie in with our top five 60s movies. That's all we're going to tell you, Maddie. You started. I'm going to give you the action.
All right. And hey, wait. All right. All
are
right.
You ready?
I'm ready.
And action.
Can I give you a lift?
Yeah, sure. Jesus, what's that?
Oh, you got your hands on my money belt. Don't do that.
That's not a money belt. That's a gun.
Well, we got to eat, don't we?
Oh, come on. What do you need a gun for?
Ever hear of Barnum and Bailey?
Yeah.
Well, I'm their lion tamer.
Come on.
That's the truth.
I think you're full of it.
You do, huh? What do you do?
Me? I'm an actress, a singer, a dancer, and a Buddhist.
In that order? I'm a cop. Would you believe that?
No, I wouldn't believe that.
And scene.
I think in the actual scene, the actress does not bust into laughter. But if you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, March 19th. And Maddie, I would say this is going to be a really tough one, but if the second to last line didn't give it away, I guess maybe your voice will?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Ouch, that second to last
this
line. They're
going
to go back
though.
Now. I do love this film. All right. Well, the winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit filmspotting.net. Pedro Almodovar, legendary Spanish director, producer, and writer, born in 1949 from very, very humble beginnings, moved to Madrid in 1967 to become a filmmaker. He's completely self-taught. And in the 1970s, he made scores of short films before 1980 in his feature-length film debut, Pepe, Lucy, Bomb, and Other Girls on the Heap, which, Adam, we're not reviewing because so many of his films are not available on DVD or via Netflix. In 1988, he was nominated for an Academy Award for Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, amazingly also not available to us via Netflix.
It is in the Viva Pedro set of eight films, but yes, not available for easy rental, unfortunately.
Right. And the film we're beginning our marathon with is The Flower of My Secret. It tells the story of Leo, a woman who lives to suffer, who writes that she is a woman created for anxiety, who finds massive commercial success as a romance novelist, but grows tired of producing pablum and turns to writing for a local newspaper under a pseudonym, all the while trying to hold her marriage together with her husband, a NATO forces colonel. But a plot summary isn't really needed here for this film. It's little more than a jumping-off point for Almodovar's style and a fun, eclectic, ensemble-based cast, which is apparent from frame one. Adam, you're very big on directors and their trademarks and their styles. From what you've seen in Flower of My Secret, are you excited for more of the Almodovar marathon?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this film did kind of fall nicely into line with some of the other Almodovar films I've seen, and it is too bad that we aren't starting with some of those older films, only because if you were going to do a complete kind of retrospective, you'd have to go back to those films and see how he developed. This is actually his 11th film, mm-hmm. The Flower of My Secret, but it is in many ways a perfect jumping off point because it also does mark, from what I've read about him and from some of the films I have seen later, it marks a jumping off point for more maturity. He goes from more of the comedic kind of farce into more serious subject matter, and we see that transition here in The Flower of My Secret, but you see all these great Almodovar elements in this film as you do in his others. You see his love, obviously, for Hollywood movies, direct references mm-hmm. to movies like The Apartment, Rich and Famous, Casablanca. There are shots, I think, definitely taken from Hitchcock here. Characters often use phrases from films to express themselves, and I think that is really interesting, especially in heavy dramatic moments, because I think it's very accurate. I think we all do that. We all think about memorable moments from films when we're ourselves in some of those moments. And I think the whole setup to the film, of course, is in many ways a Sullivan's Travels, Stardust Memories kind of thing, where you've got this character, Leo, who doesn't want to write, as you mentioned, these pink novels anymore, these fun romance novels that are kind of trashy, and she wants to write something darker and more serious. Also, of course, stories driven by female leads. Almodovar has said he thinks women are stronger and more interesting than men. Also really fun to watch, the blurring of reality and fantasy. You often get in Almodovar's films characters who are actors or they're writers, and the opening scene in this film was one where we think it's a real setup with two doctors talking to a mom who is mourning the fact that they're trying to tell her son is dead, and it actually turns out it's a training video. Of course, too, the issue of identity in general, you have pseudonyms and double lives, and the use of color that runs throughout Almodovar's films, really striking here as well. I wouldn't say that this is my favorite Almodovar film. I actually think I like Women on the Verge a little better among a few others I've seen, but it's up there. I liked it very much.
Well, this is pretty much my first exposure. I saw Volver, but I didn't even know it was an Almodovar film. The only thing I knew about Almodovar is something you touched on a little bit. My friend Robin, who's an actress, she says, you know, lamenting the fact that once you turn 40 in Hollywood, the only roles available to women are DAs and Pedro Almodovar films, and she doesn't speak Spanish, so she's up a creek.
That's a great point. But
the opening scene, you're right. I was thinking the first moment it came out, I'm like, oh, my God, what is this?
Well, he likes soap operas, and it feels like a soap opera.
It's so soap operatic, and the colors are so garish, and the lighting is so bad, and the filmmaking is actually really, really staged.
Sure.
And then, of course, he pulls back, and there's the reveal.
It's not real. Yeah.
And what I liked about him, and what I hope to discover more about him, are these little reveals throughout the entire film. You have no idea where this film's going to go. It just sort of rambles. It just sort of meanders, and it's like he puts a carrot out in front of you all the while, and he fleshes it out with these characters that all have their own stories going on. And I really, really appreciated that. My only complaint about the film is that I fell in love with some characters more than I did others, and I didn't get to spend as much time.
Such as
the sister, Crabface, and the mom. I just love those two, and especially at the end when the sister shows up at this theatrical event, you can't believe it. She has this scene-stealing scene. It's terrific.
Yeah, with Antonio there. Yeah. Actually, that's one area where I will disagree with you a little bit. I thought the scenes with the mom, with the sister, droned on a little too long.
He gets a little sidetracked in the conversation.
But again, I wanted to.
It's a lot like Volver too. He's always bringing up this idea of surrounding yourself with a supportive family or a network of friends and loved ones, and going back to the village. I really, really like those.
Well, and that was something really shocking to me. Actually, the connections between this film and Volver. The novel that she writes that no one wants to buy or whatever, the cold storage room, the basic setup of that is the basic setup of Volver. So he clearly returned to that when he was making Volver. And also you do absolutely get the mom and the sister relationship and the returning to the village. It felt very familiar in many ways, even though this film was obviously made in the mid-90s and Volver, I think, just in the past couple of years. But the film is interesting as well because I read Roger Ebert's review of it, and he loves Almodovar but wasn't a big fan of this film, and he lamented that he thought this was Almodovar maybe on a personal level trying to say, I'm like Leo, this character. I don't want to make these kind of films anymore, and you're going to have to trust me and go with me as I get more mature and into darker areas. And it turns out that that's borne out by the films we're going to watch in this marathon. He does get more serious, but there's still enough of that connection. Even a film like Volver, serious, heavy stuff going on, but great moments of comedy and light melodrama, and that's the genius of Almodovar. And, of course, Roger Ebert had no reason to really get nervous about it because he ended up loving those films that Almodovar did end up going with.
Yeah, I will say one thing I really did like is the comedy is very, very subtle. He doesn't nail the jokes. He just gives you just enough time to smile and then move on. But in the end, I have to admit, I wanted a little bit more. I just felt a little bit at sea.
Well, I do think we're going to see better films as we go through this marathon, but I do think this was a great starting off point. And I don't think it's a case where Almodovar is trying to say, you know, that was just trash and I don't want to traffic in that material anymore. As I touched on, we see these same elements from his earlier films and this film in some of his later films. But I think it is interesting that Almodovar, even through this film, as he gets darker, is still embracing the trash a little bit. I mean, when you get to the end of the film, she's still someone who is saying, I don't like these melodramatic moments. This isn't real life or whatever. But her life is actually huge melodrama. And so I think that's a way of Almodovar still kind of embracing that. We'll see what happens next week on the marathon. We're going to discuss the movie Live Flesh.
Okay, time for one last quick break. Dope will never be as cheap. The sex never is free. And the rock and roll never is great. We return to Abbie Hoffman's Stomping Grounds with our top five 60s movies. Stay with us.
It's a monsoon on this New Year's Day afternoon. Should have sown the winter rye when mama told me to. Everything's a mess, just can't seem to clean up all the party.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
And Maddie, I would say this is a pretty good week for movies, some movies we definitely think listeners should check out if they haven't, also some movies that maybe we didn't catch up with that we are curious about. We got to start, though, with my two favorite films of the year, No Country for Old Men, out now on DVD. You can see what all the hoopla is about. The Best Picture winner, of course. Doesn't include much in the way of
no
extra
commentary.
Features, unfortunately.
They don't do commentary.
No,
though,
I don't think they really
they
do.
Don't really
maybe
take it
one
seriously.
Or two, but again, I'm not sure about that. We will see what happens later down the road, maybe with a bigger release for this film. Also, Atonement is out, and it does have commentary by the director, Joe Wright, at least over the deleted scenes. There's a featurette and a few other things. The Making of Atonement, from the novel to the screen. So another one I say definitely worth checking out. Maddie, you liked it too. You just don't like the fact that I love it so much.
No, I thought it was fine. I thought it was fine. You know what? The Making of Atonement, it's going to be an hour special on that one shot.
So?
That's what it is.
I'll watch that and I'll be riveted. I'll go over it like the Zapruder film.
Good for you.
Okay. Also out, Dan in Real Life, a movie with Steve Carell we both liked from last year, Juliette Binoche, some extra features there. Enchanted is out with Amy Adams. A lot of listeners wrote in and said we needed to see that. Now it's out. I can't wait to get it on Tuesday so Sophie and I can check it out. My daughter is dying to see it. Also, Sleuth, the Kenneth Branagh
version. Oh, this is one I really want to see.
I do too. I mean, I've heard bad things about it, but you've got Michael Caine and Jude Law in it, and of course Branagh directing. Southland Tales, a movie we reviewed on the show. If you want to see a film that really is all over the place.
Oh, inexplicable.
Yeah, check it out. And then I Am Legend, a movie we were both lukewarm on, but maybe worth checking out definitely on DVD. Of course, that movie with Will Smith.
I don't know. I think it'll lose a lot of its impact on DVD.
I think it will too, right? Some of the best moments in that film are seeing some of those visuals on screen, but worth getting on DVD and checking out. You can get all the DVDs we mentioned in this segment at great prices through TLAvideo.com. Just click on the Film Spotting movie store link at filmspotting.net.
Okay, Mr. Kempinar, this is it.
This is the official last batch.
This is the last batch of Sam Van Halgren nicknames. We want to thank everybody who found their way over to filmspotting.net and threw a couple of their hard-earned dollars our way. We really do appreciate every single donation. It keeps us doing what we're doing and keeps us from doing pledge drives. I mean, we're in public radio now.
That's true.
I mean, that's a tacit threat.
It is.
No, but we really do thank you. And here are your Sam Van Halgren nicknames. Alex, Mitch and Murray, Wade, Bunch of Bums, Dennis, Hyundai on my wrist, Melissa, Bigger Mouth, Jose El Duderino, a.k.a. O Cafe Aso Para Closers, John, Furman, Arizona, Scott, Go to Lunch, Ashley, Five Cars, 15 Years, Louise, Wet Out There Tonight, Adam, It's Also Very Safe, Victor, Como In, Keith, The Drawbacks of Listening, David, Absolute Morality, Michael, Never Been on a Sit, Aaron, Mean Streak, Keith, A Sizable Investment, Manook, The Deal is Dead, Danielle, Always Be Closing, Katrin, Cold Calling, Christopher, The Toaster Miracle, that's a Silver Club donor, Adrian, I Know What the Shot Is, a Gold Club donor, Shane, Podbay Doors, a.k.a. The Machine, a Gold Club member.
We really do thank everyone. That is the official last batch. Even though episode 200 was supposed to be, we got some that kind of straggled in after the deadline. We totally understand that. We wanted to give you the nickname there. El Duderino, your nickname comes courtesy of your friend, Hannah Flight of Angel Dust, a.k.a. 7 Years of Sweetness. Both great nicknames. Mm-hmm. And Ashley, Five Cars, 15 Years, that nickname is courtesy of your brother, Scott, Go to Lunch. So, again, we thank Sam as well for all his help with these nicknames. Some great stuff there, all referencing Glengarry Glen Ross, of course, just as they did on episode 200. Our new program, though, where you send in a donation, it gets you a shot at picking a movie that we're going to discuss on the show. And we will
lay out exactly how this goes.
I don't know if maybe now is the best time to do it, but basically you donate to the show, your name goes into a hat, and how much you donate does affect how many names you get in the hat. And if we pick your name at the beginning of next month for your donations this month, you're then going to get to send in 3 movies, and we have to pick one of those to discuss on the show. So that's basically how it works.
So you get to choose the content of the show.
You do. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And right now we have a few donors that have already been part of this program. Let's single them out, Matt.
Yeah, right, exactly. If you donate, you still get your name read every
Absolutely.
Week. And we want to thank Martin in Calgary, that's a Silver Club donor, Dan from Edinburgh, another Silver Club donor, Brandy from Ada, Michigan, and Cynthia from Chicago, and Paul, Symptoms of Majesty. He already had a nickname from Hertfordshire. Oh, God, I probably just brutalized that. United Kingdom.
I'm guessing so. Thank you again to everyone for your donation.
Good times floating downward like a feather falling on to the cold hardwood floor.
Hi, Adam and Maddie. This is Sam of Fur Online from Cape Cod, and I'm just calling in for the big 200th show to personally thank you guys for all the films that you've inspired me to see. In particular, the first 2 movies by Terrence Malick, Badlands and Days of Heaven. Days of Heaven, I think, has perhaps the greatest of all cinematic visuals. From there, I also went and saw The Thin Red Line, which I had always meant to see, and later that year I saw The New World, which topped my Best of 2005 list. Now that Robert Altman has passed, Terrence Malick is the greatest and most consistent American filmmaker. Thanks again, and keep up the great work, guys.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and we did get a great voicemail there, Maddie, from our friend Sam from Fur Online, who talked about the discovery of Terrence Malick through Film Spotting, and of course that ties in with our last show, our 200th episode celebration, where we shared some of your discoveries and our discoveries as we've been doing this show now over the course of 3 years. Also want to mention Zach in Atlanta. He left a voicemail thanking you, Maddie, for some of your films from your top five of the year. Shane Meadows' This Is England, and of course After the Wedding, another film that a lot of people discovered through you, and both are definitely worth checking out. So well done, Maddie.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'd like to thank the Academy.
Let's get on to this week's top five. 60s movies, of course, in connection with Chicago 10, the right. movie we reviewed
and
in the
opening
segment.
And we had a couple rules. These are films could not be made in the 1960s.
Correct, because that's its own top five. If you wanted to actually break down every movie made in the 60s and pick the best, we're not really interested in doing that. These are movies more about the 60s, movies that are set in the 60s. That was really the criteria.
Yeah, and then it gets so tough because I actually took a class on the 1960s with a professor who was, you know, a self-described communist, and he said, you know, the 60s basically started about 1965 and ran until about 1976.
Great. That rules out most of my choices.
Yeah. So.
Okay, well, let's jump in. Maddie, you're number five.
Okay, well, first, I just want to give a quick honorable mention, a couple that won't make my list. Malcolm X, Who'll Stop the Rain, 1978, Nick Nolte, Tuesday Weld, a film worth checking out, and also Eyes on the Prize, a documentary about the civil rights struggle. Number five, it's a tie, Peter Boyle, Conspiracy, The Trial of the Chicago 8, which we already talked about earlier in the show, and Joe, Peter Boyle again as this Archie Bunker-type blue-collar racist who cannot tolerate the counterculture revolution going on around him. He befriends a businessman, and they're both forced to enter into the subculture in search of his friend's daughter, Susan Sarandon, and the results, well, I won't give anything away, but it's a very, very terrifying movie.
Yeah, I definitely need to see it. You've mentioned it a few times here on the show. For me, I left out a couple of Pantheon films that I have put in the Pantheon, and I cannot include on any top five.
You're not
going to
say
The Cuckoo's Nest.
It's not Apocalypse Now.
Raging Bull, and also The Deer Hunter. And then tying in with The Deer Hunter, I left out any Vietnam movie because,
oh,
again,
really?
Its own genre. Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, Full Metal Jacket, and yes, Apocalypse Now. All movies I like, but again, I think they just belong to their own category, and I didn't really want to get into them here. All of my choices, I think, except maybe my number two, do try to capture some sense of the whole era, mm-hmm. I think, or defining moments from the 60s. Though, again, I by no means set out to make this a list where it's like, this is America in the 60s. It just kind of worked out this way. My number five, JFK. According to Brett Morgan, the director of Chicago 10, he quotes Norman Mailer, who is in Chicago 10 as a witness. He said that the loss of America's innocence can really be pinpointed to JFK's assassination and then the 1968 Chicago riots at the end. And I have to be honest, I have not seen JFK since 1991 when it came out, but I remember really loving it. And obviously, it's one of the most fascinating mysteries ever, and I think Stone, the way he went about investigating it was fantastic, and I also think that it's great for this list because it does cover the entire decade. It opens with Eisenhower exiting, Kennedy coming in, and then ends with the trial of Clay Shaw, which happened in 1969. So you've got the entire gamut of the decade there.
Yeah, it's a great choice. It was on my honorable mention list, but I didn't want to say it because I thought it's going to make Adam's list.
Yes, it did.
All right, well, my number four is 13 Days. I never realized actually how close to nuclear war we really got. And I think Roger Donaldson's movie from 2000 starring Kevin Costner as JFK's presidential aide, Kenny O'Donnell, really, really illustrates this well. And if you want to talk about learning a lesson from history, I would urge all of today's world leaders, watch this film and learn a thing or two about restraint. That's about as political as I'll get.
Okay. Well, I do like the film 13 Days as well. Definitely one worth checking out. My number four, let's allow Jim Carrey to set it up.
You might recognize this song as performed by Jefferson Airplane in a little rockumentary called Give Me Shelter about the Rolling Stones and their nightmare at Altamont. That night, the Oakland chapter of the Hells Angels had their way. Tonight, it's my turn.
One, two, three!
When the truth is found.
We need an ambulance over by the scaffolding. The favorite line, exactly, from the movie The Cable Guy is that scene when Jim Carrey sets up the karaoke bit doing Don't You Want Somebody to Love, and of course referencing the great Maisel's documentary Give Me Shelter. A little bit of a cheat. It came out in 1970, obviously shot in 1969. Maddie, you're pursing your lips and you're making that squinty face like you're about to rag on me. That's fine. I'm going to use it anyway. this Altamont Free concert was supposed to be the apotheosis of peace, love, and understanding, and then it turns in really to the death knell for all of that, and you have the Hells Angels stabbing an 18-year-old fan who had a gun, I believe everyone now says. But it's a classic of the direct cinema style. I think the Maisels, what's really interesting about that style is they allow us to completely draw our own conclusions. If this movie is in some way about signaling the end of the 60s in a certain era in American history, they're not making that point. They're just there to observe. It's a classic.
Oh, it's a really great point. I would recommend all of the Maisels' works, Grey Gardens and Gimme Shelter, one of my favorite films of all time. All right, well, my number three, well, sort of riding your coattails a little bit. It's a documentary, and it's Vietnam, a television history. It's a PBS documentary that originally aired in 1983, and I like it because I think its breadth and its scope on the subject are pretty much unmatched, and it's brutal. It's really brutal and heart-wrenching to watch, but what I remember most is its objectivity. What I remember most are the interviews with General Westmoreland, and he talks very matter-of-factly, and I'm thinking, this is the face of evil? Can it be this guy? And I would suggest everybody check this out if you have any interest, of course, in Vietnam. All are available on Netflix.
Well, I do have an interest in those films in that period, but I need to check that out. My number three, you mentioned it, another film like JFK, where it's kind of a big sprawling movie, but it is Malcolm X, and this film does really only cover the early and mid part of the 60s. Another movie I've only seen once, but I remember loving Denzel Washington, of course, amazing as Malcolm X, and that character was just so fascinating, such a complex and, of course, tragic character, where he's ultimately gunned down in 1965 after splitting from the Nation of Islam. I just remember being riveted by the entire film, and I'm a big Spike Lee fan, so I guess that's to be expected, but I had to have it on here.
Yeah, it's a great choice. Well, all right, my number two, American Graffiti, 1972, George Lucas. Literally the night before America loses its innocence, and it's there. I mean, look at those songs that they're listening to in 1962. It's about girls. It's about feeling good. Now think about the songs like that they sang at Altamont that are going to put a bookend on the decade and how far we've come. And the reason this film is done so well is because it's these actors, this filmmaker, waxing rhapsodic on material they know so well. Mm-hmm. And I think every generation subsequently has had their American Graffiti, their movie, but I think American Graffiti is probably still the best.
Yeah, great choice. And I'm guessing what you're saying is the songs aren't like maybe Sympathy for the Devil.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Well, my number two, again, this is the one that goes against the trend I've sort of set up here, but it's Wong Kar-wai's film, In the Mood for Love. And I do have some explanation for why I think the time is relevant, why the story is set in 1962, but I certainly welcome any listeners who are out there and are much bigger Wong Kar-wai experts and want to chime in on that subject. I'll entertain any emails, but you've got the great Tony Leung and the great Maggie Cheung in this film. They're neighbors whose spouses are cheating on them with each other, and they discover that, and then that sparks a friendship between them that they don't want to be like them and ever let it go into a romantic relationship. And actually, it reminds me a lot of Almodovar, talking about The Flower of My Secret, where you've got the situation where there's a lot of blurring of reality and fantasy. You've got this couple, Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung, who they act out how their spouses met and how they would confront them if they were to. It's also interesting because if you've seen Tony Leung in films like Infernal Affairs as the conflicted cop, you see him in Lust Caution as this amazing draconian villain. You then watch him in the Mood for Love. He's the cuckolded husband. He's innocent and naive, and he wants to write martial arts novels. And that, of course, is the genius of Tony Leung, is that he can be both. And so I really highly recommend In the Mood for Love if you haven't seen it. It's actually the second film in kind of an informal trilogy along with Days of Being Wild and then 2046, which came out in 2004 and actually was reviewed here on Film Spotting. I haven't seen Days of Being Wild, and I need to see that.
Well, I need to check them all out. Great choice. All right, well, my number one is Fog of War. Robert McNamara, Kennedy's and Johnson's Secretary of Defense, the Errol Morris documentary, The Interview. This man was an architect of history, and he sits down with Morris, and he is unrelenting and so candid in his role in the Bay of Pigs and eventually Vietnam. And frame to frame, your view of the man changes from love to hate to loathing, and he refuses. He absolutely refuses to apologize, and maybe at the end of the day, he doesn't have to apologize. He'll let history decide, but this film is so captivating.
Yeah, it really is a good one. I love Errol Morris as well. My number one, let's go ahead and hear a scene.
I wonder how the press don't feel about this.
Press? What does the press have to say about it?
Yeah, what do they have to say about it? Well, do you boys know what makes this bird go up? Funding makes this bird go up.
That's right.
No Bucks, no Buck Rogers.
And press over there.
Hey, over here!
They all want to see Buck Rogers, and that's us. Buck Rogers.
Well, Maddie, we go from the Chicago 7 to the Mercury 7. This is a total nostalgia pick here, but you talk about the 60s, you have to talk about the Cold War and the space race, and The Right Stuff really does focus on just a small part of that struggle, where you've got just the first group of test pilots who were part of the U.S.'s Mercury manned spaceflight program, but Dennis Quaid, Ed Harris, Sam Shepard as Chuck Yeager, these, for me, were defining roles. I've always viewed those actors through the prism of The Right Stuff. I was obsessed with this movie when it came out in 1983, and I still watch it whenever it comes on. So I had to find a place for it on this list. I will say, though, some other honorable mentions: Zodiac, The Dreamers, M. Butterfly, the David Cronenberg movie, I'm Not There, Peggy Sue Got Married, and The Outsiders, all movies I considered but left out.
All right. Well, those are our top five 60s movies. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
How many comments do you think we're going to get about The Big Chill, Maddie?
Well, does that actually take place in the 60s?
See, that's what I said, too, and we discussed it a bit in our message boards, and they said no, but, you know, it's really about the 60s.
No,
maybe
certainly,
so, but
certainly.
It really isn't set much in the 60s. At all. Opening wide this weekend, the sci-fi horror movie Doomsday, the animated Horton Hears a Who, Do I Hear a Maddie's
Ooh,
Movie Minute?
Maddie's Movie Minute will be there.
And the action drama Never Back Down, out in limited release, though. Michael Haneke's thriller Funny Games, and on next week's
that's
show.
That's one you're really jonesing over.
I'm really jonesing, but also terrified to see it. But next week, we will try to review Funny Games and also Gus Van Zandt's latest Paranoid
Ooh, big
Park.
Week
it's a
for
big
Mr.
week
for Mr. Kempinar.
It is.
Thanks, as always, to our listener volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio. And to Wilder Embry for this week's music. Learn more at wilderembry.com. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Maddie, what?
Hey, you know, summer's right around the corner.
Really?
You're going to be heading down to Montrose Beach?
Is this an impromptu ad?
You want to look cool, right?
I do.
Like all the other cool kids. Well, I know where you need to go.
Where?
You need to go to filmspottingswag.com to get your cool t-shirts and baby onesies.
We all need a baby onesie that says Film Spotting on it. They're available in a variety of colors, at least the t-shirts are.
Very nice. Available at filmspottingswag.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips. Learn more by visiting the Film Spotting movie store at filmspotting.net. Abbie Hoffman and company take the stage in Brett Morgan's Chicago 10.
Yeah, free speech is having the right to yell theater in a crowded fire.
Yeah, I didn't want to go there, but
I love it when you pull out the voices, man.
I can't do it. But it's so funny how you know it's Hank Azaria.
Oh, yeah.
You know, doing the voice.
Well, these pigs, they come and they talk to me like I'm just some piece of ham, man. Like I'm slop for the gravy train, man. Okay.
Review it on the show.
What? Maddie's Movie Man.
John Adams, an epic miniseries.
Hey!
Down to 60 seconds.
I like my presidents fat and bald.